history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, seemingly ordinary Americans who really have done extraordinary things on our behalf. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we will never forget the price that has been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. From my personal perspective, they've been inspiring me for a long time, even before a desire to record my grandfather's World War II story led to my starting to interview veterans on television. A couple years later, we started this radio program to add to that effort, and I bring that up because this weekend holds significance. It was 10 years ago, October 7th, 2007, that the very first episode of Hometown Heroes aired on KMJ Radio in Fresno, California. It is still airing on those same airwaves, as well as quite a few other stations now, like the one you're listening to right at this moment. 10 years is a long time in the radio business, and I think it would take me at least another decade to share just how giant a blessing this has been in my life to spend time with so many amazing Americans all across this country. They've represented incredible diversity, but reflected a unity of purpose and commitment to the ideals of America, even when those ideals weren't always carried out perfectly. I've sat down with veterans in luxurious estates, as well as trailer parks, and everything in between. Sometimes we've been on hallowed ground, like the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor, or the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., in state veterans' homes in places like Ogden, Utah, or Truth or Consequence, New Mexico. Other times in settings as unique as San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf, the VA hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or a bench outside a Walmart in Mesa, Arizona, where ex-prisoners of war were handing out daisies for remembrance. The veterans themselves represent such a vast array of cultural backgrounds: Native American, African American, Latino, Filipino, Chinese American, Japanese American. That list goes on and on and on. And every corner of the political spectrum has been represented here. There's religious diversity as well: Buddhist, Jewish, Mormon, Catholic, Protestant, even a few who don't profess a faith. As different as these hundreds of veterans have been, and as unique as their individual experiences happen to be, one thing they all share, one common bond that we've seen and heard without exception, is their commitment to put the cause of our country before their own personal feelings. It has been powerful to hear that over and over again. The memory of a far from perfect, but yet united America that coalesced behind freedom and liberty and opposed tyranny around the globe. I don't think I need to point out to you how relevant that seems to be in the times we're living in now. The stories were relevant 10 years ago when we launched Hometown Heroes. Yes, they are relevant today, and I believe they'll remain relevant long into the future. We've heard this often, but it's true. Those who fail to learn from history are destined to repeat it. So let's not be those people who fail to learn from our history. I know I don't usually ramble on this long, and I'll wrap it up now because this show is not about me. It's about our veterans and the things that they endured. And I think you'll enjoy the perspective we pick up today from one ex-prisoner of war, his wife, who was pregnant with their first child when she heard that he was missing in action. And then, before our time runs out today, a little excerpt from that very first episode of Hometown Heroes that aired 10 years ago this weekend. That's what we have to look forward to, and we begin with 94-year-old Ed Crominga of Hollister, California, who nearly pulled it off. He was close to completing all 35 of his scheduled missions as a ball turret gunner in B-24 Liberators with the 454th Bomb Group, flying out of Italy. But Ed's 33rd mission in November of 1944 would become his last. He'd have to endure the rest of World War II as a prisoner in Germany. But before we get to all that, Ed, I want to hear about Anamosa, Iowa. I know your hometown is between Cedar Rapids and Dubuque, And today it's home to the National Motorcycle Museum. But I want to know, what was it like growing up in Anamosa in the 1930s?
I was still on the farm.
Uh-huh.
Born and raised there, of course.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have two sisters, or had two sisters, and how many brothers? Three?
Two sisters, three brothers.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you had a lot of chores, too.
A lot of chores. Milked usually in the neighborhood of 21 head of cattle by hand. And just about the time I left, they got a machine in there to help milk the cows and stuff instead of doing it by hand.
Came a little too late for you, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
So you milked all those cows yourself every day?
No. It was most of the time my dad and one of my brothers part-time, you know.
Yeah.
They were in and out, of course.
How early in the morning did you have to get up to go milk those cows?
Every morning. I don't know what time it was, but in the neighborhood between 5 o'clock to 6, any time in there.
I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember as a boy, do you remember having those dreams, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do, here's what I'm going to be?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure of that. Hoping to fly someplace more than anything else, I think.
Where did that come from? Where did that desire to fly come from?
I don't know. I think it was just because there was a very few planes. I know if one would fly over, you'd stop everything to watch it go. It was just something to see.
I think what I'm trying to figure out, it's how a guy as tall as you are, you're almost 6 feet tall. How did you end up in the ball turret on a B-24?
I do not know, because normally you'd have to wear your uniform for if you got hit, you could drop from the turret. I couldn't do that. I had to go back up and get mine.
In other words, it was so cramped in the ball turret of a B-24 mm-hmm. that you couldn't have a parachute with you.
That's right.
Could you even fire those guns? I mean, you must not have had much elbow room either.
Oh, yeah. No, I could move all the way around, up and down, so that I could catch the person I was supposed to try to bomb on.
And one of the main purposes of that ball turret is that you would see enemy fighters coming, if they're
yes.
coming from beneath the airplane or from the side.
Yes.
What does that feel like when you're down there and all that's separating you from those other planes is a little sheet of plexiglass,
mm-hmm.
and you know they're trying to kill you. What does that feel like in those moments?
The first thing you did is want to know where and when those planes were coming. And usually the people on top would see the enemies, I'll put it that way. I do know that every time we found out that there was a few holes that wasn't there before after we got there and back, but almost always got a few little holes or something in place. Of course, they had everything checked as soon as we got back. So,
how close were those holes to your position?
One was just over my head because I was on a ball turret underneath the plane. And in order to get information and stuff from them, I would have to crank it out and get up into their plane. Because I was sitting below. Sometimes they would help me a little bit, but then most of the time they would be looking out the windows and seeing what's going on too.
How often in those 33 missions did you actually use those machine guns that you had in the ball turret?
Well, we used them every time we went out, but most of the time it was just to make sure that it was in action and not damaged somehow.
You had to fire a burst to make sure it's operational.
That's right.
What about actually seeing fighters coming toward you?
Then you would locate them and made sure that if you had to and could shoot, have to be prepared for it.
How hard was that? Because I imagine they're moving pretty fast.
It might be fast, but we were fast and they were fast, so it's just a matter of locating them and operating your turret to that direction.
Were there times where the rounds you fired hit the enemy planes?
I'm sure, but you never knew until you got shot down. But I don't think we thought of it. We just flew, came back, got out, and of course we had to make sure our turret was up and out of the way for landing.
Dorothy's got a photo there of your crew. What can you tell me about the guys that you flew with? What were they like?
Just almost like your brothers, I guess. You became close to every one of them because you had to depend on them.
And I guess I need to explain here that all of these missions you're flying with the 454th Bomb Group, you're a married man. You and Dorothy got married 2 days after D-Day. You're carrying a picture of her in your pocket on all these missions. And then you find out while you're overseas that she is expecting your first child. What was it like to receive that news?
I think it was really something. I don't know how to explain it, but it was great to know.
Well, what happened on that 33rd mission? What do you remember? What can you tell me about that?
When we got hit?
Yeah.
I think everything was going on pretty pleasant for a while, other than the fact it was getting to be, I'm not sure how to say this, but it seemed like we flew almost right into where we're going to bomb. Of course, we had to drop the bombs.
Right.
And almost always, they would pull away from the rest of the crew and take off and locate them after they were clear. And I don't know whether the other planes did that or all that they all stayed together, but our plane always took off after bombs were dropped.
So once you drop your bomb and you peel off and you're going to return, you'd separate from the formation until they had all dropped their bombs, and then you'd form up again.
Yes.
But this time?
Well, we got hit. It was terrible. I know we got hit, and I knew I had to get out because in my turret, I couldn't get in my parachute. So I knew I had to get out and put it on, and I did that. Got my suit on and looked out the window and saw it was going down pretty fast, so I bailed out. Made one swing, swung back, and hit the bank of a river.
Because you were so low.
Yes.
Your parachute only swung out one side of the pendulum. You never went back the other way because you were so low.
Yes. You went back, but that's when we hit the bank of a creek out there that was not. There was no water in it that time. It was dry.
Uh-huh. But that impact must have been pretty strong.
It hit, but it was just happy to be down. And
were you injured?
No, I really wasn't. But the thing is, when we hit and I opened my eyes and there was two guns just a few inches from my head and two young people, very young people, holding them.
Like teenagers?
Yeah, I would say so. They were actually kids, I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
They just stood there and held the guns in my face until another guy came along and he acted like our friend.
Were you knocked unconscious when you hit?
No, sat there real still.
So of the 11 men on your crew, 5 of them died. How close do you think you were to not making it out of that?
Pretty close, pretty close.
There are guys who bailed out at that low altitude who were killed by the impact with the ground.
That's
true. 500 feet is awfully low.
My whole back was leveled with the where I came down and hit. Mm. Opened my eyes and two rifles were in my face.
Yeah. Did they say anything to you?
No. I don't know because I didn't understand them until one guy that could speak my language.
What does it feel like to be half a world away from your pregnant wife and now realize you're going to be a prisoner for who knows how long?
You know, I can't really tell you. It's.
Were you afraid?
I don't think I had time for that.
I guess what I'm interested in understanding is what got you through all that? Because you're shot down in November of 1944. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be, you don't know this, but you're not going to be liberated till the end of April in 1945. So that's a good 5 months that you were a prisoner of war. What was the hardest part of that? What was the most challenging thing to endure?
It just, nothing seemed to bother me. I knew they had to take care of me somehow or other. I just didn't seem to have any fears, bad fears.
And at age 94, Ed's memory isn't quite what it used to be. You're hearing him share today those things that are still pretty clear when he taps into the memory banks. But about 20 years ago, when even more details were readily accessible for him, he sat down and started typing out some of his experiences. What a treasure that account is for his family today. And with the Krominga's permission, I'm going to read some of that to you to help add to what we heard from Ed today, and then we'll get back to some of his thoughts here in 2017. He writes, "One day, what we considered as our buddy crew was shot down over Yugoslavia. We got word that they were captured by the group who would sell them to the highest bidder, so the U.S. eventually got them back and returned them to our base. By the time they got back, they were supposed to fly on a mission right away, but one of the men had a broken leg, so he couldn't go. The rest of them were still kind of in shock from being captured by kind of an enemy, a mercenary that would go either way for money, and they refused to fly. So we took their place for the rest of their recuperation days, and we went in their place on their mission. We had a new B-24 called Good Heavens, and we were getting used to it. Everybody had put their wives' or girlfriends' names by the positions that they flew in. We all had good, confident feelings again, and a real good feeling for the ship. We got to our plane that morning. Each of us checked out our positions and put our gear in the proper place. I put my parachute where I could find it in case of emergency. My position was ball or belly turret with twin 50s automatic machine guns with a large tray of rounds for each of the guns. It also had the latest sights to use. If you could frame the target, it would allow you for lead and distance. If I could have worn the backpack in the turret, I'd be able to open the door from below the waist and drop out that way. However, that was another story because I couldn't do it. The only thing for me was, if we lost power, I had to rely on the waist gunner to manually crank me up to get out. That man was Pete Merle. After coming out of the clouds, the squad was nowhere in sight, so there was nothing to do but stay on course to the target. We couldn't use the radio because we were in radio silence in enemy territory. As we were nearing the target, the pilot spotted another squad about ready to make their bomb run, so he sped up a great deal to catch them and drop our bombs in their pattern. It felt good to be rid of the bombs and be in the company of other planes. As we were heading home, the pilot, or navigator, saw our squad again quite a ways ahead and low. So in order to go home with our own squad, we started to drop and speed up to catch them. This must have been a day of bad decisions because they went into another cloud bank and that was the last we saw of them. At that time, the navigator told the pilot of a mobile 3-gun anti-aircraft unit ahead. The pilot didn't waste time to swing away from those guns. The navigator laughed at the sudden move and gave the pilot new coordinates to get back on track again toward home. Just as the new heading was made, the tail gunner and I saw anti-aircraft puffs right behind us at our exact altitude. We called on the intercom at the same time. There was no time to do anything. There were 3 puffs behind us, and we felt the 4th hit us. It was a hard jolt and kind of a quiet sensation. Then for me, I kind of panicked. Did I lose all power? I hit my controls hard to get the turret up so I could get out. It seemed that it wasn't going to move, but in reality, I suppose it reacted at a normal rate. As I opened the door, the crew was looking out of the waist windows. When Pete saw me, he said, "My God, I forgot you might need help." I went to the window also. We could see the landing strip below that we seemed to be circling. We had done this before, but not quite as tight a circle. I asked one of the crew if anyone had checked forward. He said no. When I opened the bay doors and looked forward, I could see a large hole where the nose wheel had been, and the pilot and co-pilot, and just above that with nothing to protect them. I told the crew of what happened, and we were starting to spin faster and tighter. The wind took me right out. I felt my chute pop, jerking me around in a swing. Saw the plane crash just ahead of me, with the engines being the largest things I could see. I started to swing back and found myself hitting the side of the ditch. This all happened so fast I didn't realize much until I felt myself being dragged by my chute. Ed goes on to describe his time in captivity, from his interrogation to the 3 different German prison camps he ended up in, even meeting a young man from his hometown of Anamosa, Iowa, at one of them. He also describes his liberation from Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany, where he was for roughly 2 weeks until General Patton and his forces came to liberate them. Of coming home, he says, "One night, coming in late, we could actually see the Statue of Liberty, really quite a sight to us all." And after coming ashore in New York, he took a train to St. Louis, and from there would head back to his native Iowa. And I think you should hear that in Ed's voice, not mine.
Oh, I couldn't wait to see the farm again. Weren't actually prisoners anymore, but they treated us like as if we're kings and queens or something like that for a while.
What did it feel like to stand next to that crib and see your baby daughter for the first time?
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. It was something else. I don't know what I'd do without them. That's for sure, all of them down.
And Dorothy says she wins all your arguments. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. She knows how to talk.
Well, we're going to hear her talk in just a minute. It's time for a break. But when we come back, a perspective we probably don't get enough on this show, that of a young wife who knows her husband is flying dangerous missions, then finds out he's missing, then that he's a prisoner, and finally has her dream come true when he shows up back in Iowa. But wait until you hear what exactly that sight he saw was when he tapped on her bedroom window in the middle of the night on what just happened to be their first anniversary. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
This
is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and another ex-prisoner of war story today, told in a variety of ways. What B-24 ball turret gunner Ed Crominga wrote down about his experiences years ago, what is still fresh in his memory today, and in a moment, what his wife of 73 years, Dorothy, has to say about the first of those 73. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of the Cromingas as newlyweds, as well as a current photo of the pair standing in the front yard of their home in Hollister, California, where underneath the stars and stripes flies another flag with the POW/MIA insignia and the words, "You are not forgotten." That flag holds special significance, as we'll hear from Dorothy, but if you've got a marriage that's lasted 73 years and counting, there must have been a pretty powerful first impression, right? Well, yes, Dorothy says, but not exactly the kind of impression you might expect.
Well, I really didn't like him very much.
You didn't?
Mm-mm.
Why not?
I don't know. A little cocky, maybe.
Well, I'm sure you broke him with that, right?
Really, it didn't take me long.
Where was it you guys met?
My brother dated a young lady that he liked very much, and they broke up, and then she was getting married to their best friend. It's his cousin that my brother was going with, and of course we were good friends, so we were invited to the shower. That's where I met this gentleman, and that's when I didn't like him.
Uh-huh.
But it took me a few months, and I liked him.
What changed?
I could see what kind of a person he really was, and I liked it. He wasn't one of these aggressive people. I just knew he came from a good family, German family. And that's what I was, German family.
Yeah.
So from there on, we just hit it off. It was a great life from there on.
Were you at all hesitant to marry this guy, knowing that he was going to be going overseas and risking his life?
It took me a while to considering that. But I didn't want to lose him either. So I decided to go ahead with it, get married. He gave me his wings. That took care of that. I went to Charleston, South Carolina, where he and his crew were stationed. My sister went with me, and we had a military wedding. All the crew was there, and I was found out in September that I was actually pregnant, and I thank God for that. And then in Armistice Day, that day, he was shot down, and then I was more thankful that I was pregnant.
Explain that for me. Do you mean so you would have a piece of him no matter what?
I guess that was my thing that... It was a terrible blow, of course, but I just was thankful that I would have that part of him. So as soon as I knew, I told him, and then, of course, he knew it, that we were going to have a baby.
You wrote him a letter?
Yes.
Right. So he knew that before he was shot down?
Before he was shot down. Mm-hmm. So that was September, then he was shot down on 11th of November.
And how did you find out that he'd been shot down?
His mother and dad got the telegram. I didn't get it. Of course, it was wartime and papers, you know how that goes.
It hadn't caught up to the Air Corps yet that he was married.
That was fine. And Mother and Dad didn't tell me right away. Mother and Dad Crominga didn't tell me right away because they knew I was pregnant. They didn't want me to know that. Well, I guess then they talked to their attorney, and he said, "No, you must tell her." So then it was in the middle of December that they finally told me. And then on New Year's Day, we were all together at his family's farm for New Year's. And we got a telegram that he was a prisoner of war. So that lifted our spirit a little bit.
Because until that point...
We didn't know.
So it's just as possible that he's dead.
That's right.
How did you keep from being consumed by that fear or concern?
I think I was more than I... You know, when you're young, it's different. I think back now and I thought, how did I handle that? But I remember now that if I ever prayed, I prayed then. Now I'll probably get emotional. But... He came home, and let's see, we never heard from him again until he called me from Missouri. There were 21 days coming after he was liberated, and you ask one of the questions to him about had he lost a lot of weight, and he had, but I wasn't aware of it, because when he came home, he was a pudgy little guy, because they had fed them so much on the ship coming over. They were in a hit storms on the water coming over, and anyhow, he said they lost quite a few of the guys because they just wouldn't listen. They ate way too much, and that was a tragedy.
Mm.
But anyhow,
So you recognized him fine because all the weight he lost, he put back on the ship.
Right. But then he lost it all again. It didn't take him long to, because food just didn't have anything. He just didn't like food, no kind of food.
So the whole time that he was a prisoner, you never heard from him?
No postcard, nothing? No, nothing.
And he didn't receive anything from you, even though I'm sure you wrote?
Oh, yeah, I did. And then Bruce Key, this gentleman here, he took care of all the belongings that the crew had left behind. And
so that was a gentleman who was supposed to be on the mission?
But didn't go that day.
But didn't go. Mm-hmm. So what did he do?
He sent everything. Ed's Christmas package that was pulverized by that time.
That you had sent there?
That sent to Ed, yeah.
Yeah.
And all the mail, all the pictures out of his billfold that he thought he should have. He took all his girlfriends out, of course.
Likely story.
He made a big joke of that. Uh-huh. But anyhow, that was wonderful to have that all sent back.
What about the day-to-day? I mean, we have two children, so I know what it's like. I know what pregnancy does to a woman and the roller coaster you're on to begin with. And then you've got this added dynamic of not knowing if your husband's coming home or not. How torturous were those months for you?
I had a lot of sleepless nights, lots of them, but I was stayed with my parents. I went back home. And I have a big family, a family of eight, my parents, of course, and they all stood behind me, and they just think the world of him. I said they thought more of him than he did of the poor thing. But he's always been a special person in our family.
Were there days where you didn't think he would be coming
home? I
really
didn't. I had really given up. Mm-hmm. But then I had more hope after we got the telegram that he was a prisoner. But you heard so much about what was going on with the prisoners that you had hope, but you didn't have hope. Mm-hmm. So I know I spent a lot of awake nights and walking the floor nights and listening to everything I could on our battery radio, you know, how that is. And then I get a call from Missouri. Here he is. Didn't hear from him all that time. We knew he must be liberated if he's a prisoner. We know he must be coming home, but you still don't hear anything. But he's here. He's supposed to call from New York, but they couldn't.
So that had to be a little nerve-wracking because you're doing the math saying, okay, mm-hmm. Now I've got this baby. Where's my husband? I know he's been liberated. Why haven't I heard from him?
Somebody, anyhow.
Yeah.
And I didn't. But I don't think I can ever explain the feeling when he called that day from Missouri. I just don't think I could ever get over that feeling.
Do you remember what he said?
You know, I just know he called. It's unbelievable. You're so emotional. I honest to goodness can't tell you.
It was a dream come true, though.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. That was exactly what it was.
So then you said, when are you actually going to come home, right?
He said, I think tomorrow. I think he said he'd be home tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
But that was the 7th of June. Our wedding anniversary, first wedding anniversary was on the 8th. And would you believe that it must have been about midnight, colder than Dickens in Iowa at that time. I thought it was. And he knocked on my bedroom window. Or there was a knock on my bedroom window. And the funny part of it was I had long blonde hair in those days. And mother had, I'd shampooed my hair because I knew he was coming home. And she wrapped my long hair in dad's stockings, white work stockings. So I was beautiful. And at the time, after I had my baby, I had acquired eczema on my hands years before, and they had cured it, they thought, but having my pregnancy, it came back. So mother had doctored my hands and put my hands in sugar bags. Back then you bought your sugar in sugar bags. So my stockings and my hair, sugar bags on my hands, and I had to go to the door to greet my husband.
On your first anniversary?
On our first anniversary. So he was home on our first anniversary.
Well, you just had to make it unforgettable for him, right?
I did. I tried. I tried.
With sugar bags on your hands.
Oh, Lord. I tell you.
And stockings.
In those times, you didn't have a camera ever, you know, like you do now. And I just wish that somebody could really take a picture so I could prove what I must have looked like.
That's all right. They say radio is theater of the mind, and you're painting a real captivating picture right now. And, you know, we talked about the fact that he didn't know if you guys had a boy or a girl. Mm-hmm. Did you wake the baby to see him, or did you wait till the morning?
No. She was in her crib right beside my bed, and I'll always see him as long as I live. Him standing there looking at her. That's what he did.
quite adoringly, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. And he said, it's a girl.
Yeah, what a way to find out. So did he tell you much about what he'd been through?
No, not for a long time. No, as a matter of fact, he talked very little about it. Very, very little. And he wasn't well for a long time. He had some kind of, it wasn't malaria. No, he didn't have that. And we finally found a doctor that diagnosed it. But every 3 months he'd become very ill. I don't want to even describe it. It was terrible.
For how long?
He did that until, well, our children, these two, our other two children. Well, I guess I should go back to Manya. No, not yet. Yes, I should. Our first big little girl was named Manya. And she and I, after he was home, 51, she died. She and I were in an accident, and we lost her. But after that, then we had these children. We had Amaya first, and then we had Brad. I didn't think we'd ever have any children, and we did. Thank God. So it must have been, oh dear.
This was an illness as a result of his malnutrition as
right,
a prisoner
right,
that just
yes,
kept coming yes. back
but
over
had,
and over.
But we just had to find a doctor that could diagnose it, which he did. And they made a serum from cultures from him and injected it again every so often.
Self-inoculated.
Yep, right. Uh-huh. And but he went through a terrible time for, must have been about 55 that he finally started to come out of that.
Hmm. Is there a part of his story, what he went through, what happened to him, what he survived, that has always impressed or amazed you, or that you say, boy, how did that happen? How did he do that?
I think the only thing, he's a very strong faith. He has a faith that Deborah Alter. He just, I wish I had all of it, but I think I had a part of it. But he really is a faithful, just a faith of, I just can't imagine.
So you think that's what got him through that.
And to this day, that's top priority with him. He's just been a wonderful dad, a wonderful husband, and I know my family just really, dearly loved him.
73 years of marriage already.
Mm-hmm.
What's your secret?
I think the biggest thing is caring and communications. The older I get, the less communication I see among people. And if you don't have that, you just can't tolerate what goes on around you. You've got to talk and work things out, and I can't honestly say we had plenty of disagreements because I'm strong and he's the one that smiled at me. But I always won.
Naturally.
His thinking, when you need to work something out, he's the one that can do it.
Mm-hmm.
He has the knowledge and the faith to do it. He does it. He never changes.
I don't want to forget to ask you about that flag, that POW/MIA flag flying so prominently right in front of your home. Why is it so important to you and Ed to have that there for everybody to see?
He's wanted it for a long time. We were never really sure if we could fly it or not, but he wanted it because in memory of his crew. He loved his crew, and they all loved each other. They were a great bunch of guys. Matter of fact, Pete Merle, this little guy here, a little Italian, he was our best man in our wedding. And we've spent a lot of time with he and his wife. He wanted it because he wanted it a memorial for his crew and those that didn't come home.
Mm-hmm.
And but they went. Because it was for POW as well as the ones that were still missing. We still consider them missing, you know, in action, which they are.
Yeah.
Because they, to our knowledge, they were never recovered. The pilot, Jay, we were in contact with his mother a lot. And he never came home. So from what Ed had told us in the beginning, that front of the plane was all gone. He knew that everybody up there was gone.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't have survived that, the way it was blown apart.
Mm.
That was the one part he did tell us. He knew they wouldn't be coming home.
Is there anything else that you want to say about him or
Ed?
Yeah, or about what you went through as a wife and a mother with a husband who's a prisoner across the world?
Well, everybody that had a husband and didn't have a husband like I had, because there just aren't very many like him. I think more about how did I do it now than I did back then. When you're young, I think you can handle things a little bit better. I know it was terribly hard. And when I knew people that lost their husbands or sons or daughters, I suffered for them because I knew it was tough because what I'd gone through, but I still wouldn't trade him off.
What do you think is the biggest difference between America today and America back then?
Oh, that's a big question. I am so upset about all of this world. I just don't believe there's what's going on, what's happened. Generations through our lifetime have changed so drastically. And I can remember my mother saying, oh my, I thought, oh, what would she say today? I think about that. Mm. And I thought, oh, mother, what's so bad about it, you know?
Do you think there's something we could learn from how America responded to that situation during World War II that would help us out today?
Well, I would hope so. But people are so divided today. They don't listen. I think they want too much. Don't give enough. I don't know. I'm past knowing, I think. I just don't understand it.
Well, maybe what you just shared, that it is better to give than to receive, and the reality that putting that into practice often allows us to end up receiving more than we even give. Maybe that's something some of us listening to you today were supposed to hear. That's Dorothy Krominga, and I'm so thankful we got to add her perspective to the mix today. Don't forget to pull up the photos of Ed and Dorothy at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're not quite done yet. I mentioned this weekend marks the 10th anniversary of the very first episode of this program. We'll go back for a few highlights from that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I know this has not been a typical episode, but I sure am thankful for the privilege of sharing some time with Ed and Dorothy Krominga and examining the POW experience through multiple lenses today. If you caught the beginning of today's program, you heard me mention that this weekend marks the 10th anniversary of the first episode of Hometown Heroes. Intended at the time to complement a series of television features I'd been airing for a while, the reality as we approach our 500th episode of this show, is that a large portion of the veterans who've shared their stories here are no longer with us. But the guest on episode numero uno is still going strong now at the age of 94. I had the privilege of visiting with Augie Macaluso and his lovely wife Ida again this week, 10 years after we first met. I've shared a fresh picture of the couple for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And if you want to hear that entire original episode, you can pull it up on hometownheroesradio.com. But here's some of the story. We're going to pick it up with Augie, a 20-year-old infantryman from Pennsylvania, arriving in Europe in late 1944 with the 106th Infantry Division.
We relieved the 2nd Infantry Division, the 23rd Regiment, and they had moved all the way up to the Siegfried Line, but then had to pull back because of the lack of supplies. But they had dug in pretty heavily, and they had good fortifications that we assumed. As they left, they said, you lucky guys, you're in a quiet zone. You really have it made. Well, that didn't last very long. Exactly 5:30 in the morning, December 16th, the German artillery opened up with a barrage that lasted for nearly an hour. If you would liken yourself to being in an aluminum or a metal shed and had somebody throwing gravel at you, that's what it sounded like when we were in this earthen bunker. There were our shells all around the area. Fortunately, there were no direct hits. We knew something was going to happen, but we had no idea it was going to be as massive as it was.
You did all right the first day, surprised as you were, but it wasn't long before you ran into something that you weren't exactly prepared for, at least that you had no chance to fight against. Tell me about that.
That's true. The outfit to the left of us was overrun, and we in turn were overrun by the Germans. And directly in front of us was a minefield, heavily mined. It had been mined by the Germans when they withdrew. It was mined by the 2nd Infantry Division when they were there, and we were there long enough to put some mines out. So you didn't dare go out into that territory unless you had a guide who knew exactly where the mines were. So when the Germans came in and captured us, they told us that we, by putting Schmeisser machine pistols to our head, that we had to move across that minefield. Well, we were reluctant, but when you're looking at a Schmeisser machine pistol, you decide that you'd better go. We had to go over a double-apron barbed wire fence. It was shaped like the letter A, with strands of barbed wire on each side. You had to pick your way over. As a result, I was the last one in the group, and I was the last one with a German right next to me. There were artillery shells coming in at that time because we had asked for close fire. These were American artillery shells. And the German who was right next to me was as frightened as I was. He ran up a number of yards in front of me, and when he did that, I moved off to the left as fast as I could and made a headlong dive into a snowbank.
Knowing full well that when you try something like that, they're liable to turn one of those Schmeissers on you and let loose, right?
Yes, I felt that that could happen at any second.
But it didn't.
Fortunately, no. And it was almost twilight, almost dusk at that time. And when I went in, I just didn't move. I stayed in position for endless amount of time. After about 3 or 4 hours, I looked around to see, pull my head out of the helmet, because my helmet had frozen in the snow. I pulled my head back and tried to locate where I was, but I couldn't get any direction at all. Finally, German artillery illuminated some of the buildings in the little village that we had been protecting, and I knew now what direction to go. My fists, which were underneath me, were now frozen solid, so the only way I could find my way out was to put my fists into the footprints that I had made as I dove into that area. As I did that, my right hand hit something metallic, and I realized it was probably a mine called a Bouncing Betty or a Bouncing Betsy.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me another half hour to move after that because I was really frightened when I realized I only missed that by a number of inches.
Now, you knew which direction you were heading in, but did you know who had control of that area where you were headed?
I did not know at that particular time. The only thing I did know that about 50 yards on each side of me, I could hear Germans talking. So I'm now in the German lines. And before I made this burst to go across there, the American artillery started to fire in that area. So I had gone through a German artillery fire a couple of days before, and now I am enduring an American artillery fire. And their bits of shrapnel were coming right over me, and you could hear them just twisting and turning and singing as they would land in the snow. It really frightened me. When I hit that double apron barbed wire fence, running up to it, I felt as though I was running on my knees because my legs were so frozen. I hit that double barbed wire fence and flipped over and then began to run, expecting any minute to have bullets hitting me in the back because the Germans weren't that far from me. Apparently, they were as surprised as I was to be out there. As I got closer to the position that we had held before I was captured, I heard somebody say, "Halt."
Uh-oh.
Halt is the same in German as it is in English, but this one had a little bit of a southern tinge to it, and I knew it had to be Captain Comer, my captain from Alabama. It was, and I was home safe, at least for a while.
Prayers answered, at least for now.
Yes. I reported to him what had happened. I told him about the position of the Germans, where they were firing, when they were firing. I told him what happened to our squad, that all had been captured, including myself, but I was the only one who got away. That included my squad leader, and my assistant squad leader. The assistant squad leader was wounded at the particular time when we were captured from those artillery shells that came in. I learned later that he died in a prisoner of war camp. But my sergeant, Sergeant Roberts, is alive. He survived, and I'm still in contact with him these many years later.
I want to talk about Sergeant Roberts. The day that the attack started, December 16th, he had a little problem with his wristwatch?
Yes, his GI watch malfunctioned, and he said to me, "Mac," he referred to me as Mac, "would you mind letting me have your wristwatch?" And I was reluctant to do it because this had been a Christmas gift, an early Christmas gift to me, given to me by parents before we left to come overseas. And I said, "Yes, I'll give it to you, but whatever you do, please return it." Well, he was taken prisoner, and he was in prison until late May of 1945.
And in a POW camp, if you have something like a watch, that's going to be hard to keep without trading it in for something or out having it confiscated, I imagine.
Yes, he could have sold or given it away, sold it, whatever. He could have bribed the Germans with it. He could have had food, whatever he needed, he could have had if he would give up that watch. But he did not.
He did not, but you didn't get it back. And years passed. And I want to bring in another guest to the program. A little bit of a surprise for you here, Augie, someone who knows the story that we're talking about. We have Stuart Stern with us from Seattle, Washington. Stuart is an Academy Award nominated screenwriter, won an Emmy Award for his work. But back in 1944, he was in Europe, too, with the 106th. And Stuart, I understand that in 1977, you arranged a meeting between Augie and Sergeant Roberts.
I guess I did. It's hard to remember back that far. I remember the bulge better than 1977. Hi, Augie.
Hi, Stuart. This is a surprise. A real surprise. So good to hear you.
And maybe not as big a surprise as what happened at that dinner in 1977. Augie, tell us what you experienced while you were waiting for dessert.
Well, we were waiting for dessert. Sergeant Roberts leaned over to me and he said, Augie, I have something that I want to give to you that I promised I would return. And at that moment, he gave me the watch. 33 years later, I had my watch back.
And it still works?
It still works. It's kept in a safe deposit box at the bank, but one of our children will get it eventually, I'm sure.
Stuart, I want to ask you, as the witness to that reunion of Augie and his watch, which obviously there are a few more things more important to him than his watch, but a pretty special moment for him at that point. Do you recall his reaction, the expression on his face, what that moment was like to be sitting there with him?
Well, it was a mixed moment. He was thrilled to get the watch, but not entirely thrilled about where it had been. Because Sergeant Roberts, when he was captured by the Germans, knew that he had his honor pledged on protecting that watch. And the big question was where would he be able to hide it? And he finally, literally, found a place on his anatomy where that watch would be safe and where nobody could possibly have found it. And I don't think I'll go into details, but that watch has been to places that most of us have never been. And still, when he handed it to Augie was just thrilled to death.
Well, Augie conveniently left those details out the first time he told me about that, so I'm glad that you were able to bring the full depth of that story and the efforts to which Sergeant Roberts went.
Well, I think anything, you know, the battle was so extreme that it took, you didn't care how extreme you had to be to protect the things that you cared about, because the smallest thing became, especially if it was lent to you by a friend, the most important thing in the world.
Isn't that eloquently put? What else would you expect from a writer as gifted as Stuart Stern, responsible for the James Dean hit Rebel Without a Cause, among others? Stuart Stern passed away in 2015, but the friend he surprised by phoning in on the very first edition of Hometown Heroes 10 years ago is still going strong at 94. What a joy it was to reconnect with Augie Macaluso this week. That original episode has more from Augie, more from Stuart Stern. And not only do I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, we also have the television story that accompanied it. So that watch, that priceless memento that carried so much symbolic value, you can see that watch along with Augie's smiling face when he shared his story on TV 10 years ago, while also giving us a debut radio episode that foreshadowed so many of the elements that have been so compelling in story after story. The close call, the horror of being captured, in his case, the thrill of surviving a daring escape, and the one that's always most powerful for me to hear, that unshakable bond that develops among men who put themselves on the line for each other. So thanks to Augie Macaluso. Thanks again to Ed and Dorothy Krominga today. And thank you for listening to the first 10 years of Hometown Heroes. Lord willing, the next 10 will be just as meaningful. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free.